Welcome to the Seamus Heaney Center podcast. You're listening to The Edit with Emma Devlin, Sharon Dempsey, and Niamh McCann as they discuss the progression of their respective PhDs and about writing in the center. Today we are joined by a special guest calling in via Zoom. Due to the unique recording setup of this episode, please excuse the decreased audio quality. Enjoy!
Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Edit. Our show will endeavour to delve into our diverse research interests, exploring our creative research practice and contextualising it within the cultural landscape. So today I'm joined by my co-host, Emma Devlin. Niamh McCann, who's usually with us, is unfortunately sick at the minute. Get better soon, Niamh. We are missing you. But we're very happy to say that on this episode, we're joined by a very special guest who we will bring on a little bit later. But first of all, we're going to have a little recap of what we've been at in the past sort of 6 months and over the summer. Emma, what are you working on at the minute?
I'm just working on at the moment an article that I'm finessing for a post-conference publication. It's the first time I've ever done that. It was based on a piece of research I actually did sort of the tail end of 2020, but various things because of the pandemic kind of got delayed and things, so I'm kind of submitting it now. It's about animal autobiography and the Anthropocene and agency, so it's all of my research interests dead on.
Yeah, totally on brand for Emma Devlin, that's what I would say. Perfect. I've actually got something similar coming up. It was a conference in Bamberg, Captivating Criminality, and I didn't get to present in person because unfortunately I dreaded COVID had struck, but happily enough, they allowed me to present virtually. And so now I'm starting to think about the process of submitting my paper for publication. So I will be picking your brain either today or another occasion about that.
I think there are some better brains you could probably pick, Sharon.
No, I don't think so. Nobody better. But it's interesting when you go to a conference and you're presenting your paper and then what that paper looks like between being sort of an oral presentation and what it is as a written piece of work. There's a massive disconnect, and yeah,
absolutely,
it should be very smooth, that transition, you know.
But doesn't feel very smooth.
No, it is very different. And you know, I've seen other presenters at conferences literally read their paper, and now that I'm a third year into this PhD experience, I'm not calling it a journey, I refuse to call it a journey, I can see that they're the ones who probably have the easier job afterwards, whereas I go in and I try to engage my audience, I try to present in an entertaining way.
Yes,
and
that's my instinct as well, absolutely. I don't know about you, but I've listened to sort of speakers just read their presentations off and I cannot focus on them. I can go up to a certain point and then afterwards I just think, like, I've forgotten what you said earlier, it's an academic kind of jargon and I'm not following this. So my instinct is to try and put on a show. Interesting. But a bit of pizzazz, you know.
Yeah, you want, you know, your audience to be as excited about your material as you are, you know. So there's something that has to happen for that engagement. And I think reading a paper straight can't achieve that. You know, but maybe the clue is in writing the paper, then creating the presentation. And then afterwards, you go back to the contained paper, the proper piece of work, and that makes it easier. So yeah, we've talked ourselves into a system there.
I actually go the opposite way around. Whenever I'm about to present, I have my research, you know, but it's not put together as such. But I put it down in such a way that as if I'm going to, like, I write myself a script as if I'm sort of addressing people. So I don't write it like a proper paper, but I have all the points there that I want to talk about, but I have all of my little cues and things, and it's not written necessarily in the same way that a paper would be, you know, like a written paper in a journal would be.
Yeah, God, it's interesting how, you know, we're all on the same sort of experience of doing our creative research here, but we've all got different approaches as well. And that's sort of the whole point of this podcast is to share that experience and share creative practice and try to help each other. And I think that's a good moment to bring in our guest, the very distinguished Elizabeth Mannion, who is joining us today from New York. Her research focuses on theatre and an interdisciplinary range of Irish studies, from the revivalist drama to contemporary crime fiction. She is the co-editor with Brian Cliff of the Edgar Award-nominated Guilt Rules All, which is never far from my desk. She is the editor of the contemporary Irish detective novel and the author of the urban plays of the early Abbey Theatre. Her research has appeared in numerous journals and anthologies, including A History of the Irish Working Class Writing, published by Cambridge University Press, which was, of course, edited by Queen's very own Michael Pearse. She has spoken at numerous events hosted by a range of academic and non-academic institutions, from the National Library of Ireland and New York's Glucksmann Ireland House. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, Beth. She teaches at Baruch College in New York City and is currently working on a new book which examines the theatre of Wallace Shawn. Beth, thank you so much for joining us today. That's quite an introduction. You're very accomplished. And for that reason alone, we're very, very happy to be able to dissect your brain today and get insight into your processes and your own doctoral journey and see how that went. So what can you tell us about your experiences?
Well, first, thank you so much for including me in the edit. I think what you're doing is pretty amazing. And I'm kind of curious right now how many other colleges have something like this to offer to share with other graduate students. My journey, what was it like to do the PhD, do you mean?
Yeah.
It was so unexpected, I can't begin to tell you. I had a background in advertising and marketing, and I was speaking at an advertising conference here in the city, and there were a lot of students there from local colleges, and one of their teachers came up to me and said, "You're very good with the students. I need somebody to cover an advertising course while we go look to hire somebody to cover it. Would you be interested? It's just one night a week, basically teaching the basics of advertising." I said, "Sure, I can do that." And it only took, I think, two classes, and I thought, oh, this is what I want to do. I've never been particularly well suited to sitting at a desk all day, you know? And I'm also not very comfortable with selling, which obviously if you're working in advertising, you have to do. So I started planning, okay, what do I want to do that will bring me joy? And that's going to be something I'm going to hopefully talk to you more about as students. And I started planning on getting a master's degree, which was something I always wanted to do anyway. And I sold my apartment, went back to school, quit my job, did the whole thing, thinking that at the end of the master's, I would teach high school or maybe a community college here in the States. But that master's program included an Irish literature course and my first trip to Ireland. And while I was in Dublin, I went to look at Trinity, as you do if you're a tourist. And I happened to meet some teachers and got to talking with them and thought, okay, maybe I'll come over here and do another master's degree in film and drama. They had a program in that. And that will complement the literature degree. And I'll be even in better shape to teach high school or a community college. And I'm still not entirely sure how I wound up in the PhD program, to be honest with you. But it was a great experience, in part because of, I had a wonderful supervisor named Steve Woolmer, who I think has since retired. And he sat me down for our first meeting. And he said, so you want to find out what plays existed before Sean O'Casey? I said, yes, that's my big thing. He said, okay, we have to read everything, because I was focusing on the Abbey. And I said, well, I think I have read everything. He said, no, you haven't read everything. And once you've read everything that was published from when the Abbey opened until today, we can have a conversation. And I spent, I'm guessing, an entire summer in the archives at the National Library of Ireland and a little bit in early printed books at Trinity and read all the plays. And it was such an exciting experience to do the digging and play detective. Obviously, my interest in crime fiction comes from a place. So it was unexpected, but it was thrilling to me to have a completely wide open space to just see what I could find. I loved every minute of it, except for the typing.
That sounds absolutely fascinating, Elizabeth. Like, I'm really, this is the story of people falling into a PhD is so common. Like, I've heard that so many times from people that are kind of like, I'm not quite sure how I ended up doing this, especially in a subject, you know, maybe their master's was a different subject, or their even their undergrad or their job backgrounds and stuff. It seems to be like a very common story. And I think that's kind of like why we at the edit here like talking about this kind of stuff, because I feel like academia is kind of like shrouded in this sense of like, I don't know, it's very mystified or something. People kind of like, I don't know, they feel like there's a linear path or something, when it's very, very random and stuff. It's chance meetings, and it's, you know, you come across something and you think, oh, I could talk about this, or I really like doing this, you know. So yeah, it was really good to hear that story from someone else.
Did you find, I wonder, as I did, that you felt a certain amount of, I don't know if insecurity is the right word, but there were always people in the cohort who had a plan. They're going to do this, then do that, then do this. And I felt like a bull in a china shop. I was just winging it, you know? And so I'm happy to hear you say that you've encountered other people who sort of did it all by chance, because I really did feel like I was the only one at the time.
I think a lot of has to do with being open, though, to different experiences and opportunities. And I think that's what the PhD has given me, in particular, opportunities that I didn't realize were there for me. And there's a privilege that goes along with that I'm so grateful for. But again, you do. And I think with being creative PhD students, Emma and I are both down this creative route, you do feel that it's slightly different from the other students. You know, I don't know, Emma, how you feel there. You get that too, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah, because sometimes, you know, the training courses and things that we would go on for preparing for your viva, preparing for differentiation, getting your notes down, all kind of the real nuts and bolts of the academic sort of side, it feels like it's very much geared towards that type of experience as opposed to a creative one. And it's even things like you know, the peer profiles, where your research profiles go. It's how do we navigate that as creative writers? Like, what how do we put our literary output down as like a I don't know how you'd put it, like a record of academic kind of achievement. I don't know. It's trying to navigate all that whenever you're sort of a little bit left of center, you know.
Yeah. But I think being left of center is our strength, and we don't recognize that enough. And I think that's like third year. That's my intention. It's how we can disrupt what is there and make it work for us better. You know,
disruption's definitely a huge part of. I feel like I'm using the word disrupt in like every other sentence.
Really? Well, we're on to something then. So, Beth, how do you feel looking in at us as creative sort of doctoral students? How would you advise us? And do you come across creative doctoral students in your work?
I never have. I never heard of a program like the one you're in until you first told me about it when we met a year or so ago. And I think it makes perfect sense to me, because it can only strengthen the work of a playwright, a filmmaker, a novelist, a musician, you know, whatever your discipline happens to be, because you're forcing yourself to look at the work from underneath and from the side, not just from above, which I think is or can be an obstacle for some people who are pursuing graduate work. If you only look at it from above, I think it locks you in to being less receptive to the chance, the opportunity, the disruption, as Emma put it. So I think what you're doing is fantastic. I'm kind of curious though, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Are you required to do the theoretical piece before you start on the creative piece, or how does that work?
Well, it's very much dependent on the student and their supervisor, but I think you sort of, you know, to even get on to this sort of program, you need to sort of come with a very clear idea of what you want to do. So you have to have done quite a lot of thinking and a little bit of research and reading around your area. So for instance, my research, I was very interested in gender and class and how we read crime fiction to learn about that. And I specifically then wanted to look at that in Northern Irish crime fiction. But within a year of doing it, I realized well, even that's too broad. I need to simplify it again. And so now I'm looking at the female body and how it's portrayed and what it tells us about class and gender in crime fiction from Northern Ireland. And I think it's that process that you, you know, learn how to trim what you're looking at to tell you something very, very specific. And then to be able to use the creative part of the research to explore that and to really show that in action. I think that's what's so exciting about it.
So the two pieces sort of feed off of each other and you go back and forth with them.
Yeah, and they're in dialogue. They're constantly in dialogue, you know, and maybe, yeah, sorry, Emma, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add to that. You could have a bridging statement between the two to sort of, in your overall thesis, to kind of explain where the linkages come from and stuff, because they may not necessarily on the surface be immediately, okay, I see the links, do you know what I mean? But it could, there could be like a research link between them or a common kind of research goal that's maybe not immediately obvious.
Yeah, the creative isn't answering to the critical or vice versa. They're in dialogue. I think that's the easiest way to think of it, you know?
Can I ask?
Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm curious about something else. So when somebody's doing a traditional, like I did, kind of literary analysis piece with a, you know, historical component to it. One of the challenges that I did find was trying to constantly, you know, like once a month or so, have to pop into JSTOR or some other database and see if what's new, always what's new, always what's new. What am I missing? What's current? Constantly updating. Did the two of you encounter this on the creative side? I'm wondering, I mean, obviously you have to stay on top of current research for your theoretical piece. But do you find yourselves looking at what people are producing creatively to see how it impacts or in any way informs the creative part of your projects?
Most definitely, yeah. Constantly looking for other work that addresses my themes. The themes of my novel are very much about a sexual assault and victim shaming. So there's, you know, on the back of the Me Too movement, fourth wave feminism, we're starting to see more of those novels coming through now. So yeah, literally every month my to be read pile is growing.
So you're staying on top of novels. And Emma, what are you staying on top of?
Well, my project's the creative side is a series of short stories, and it's focused on kind of like life during the Anthropocene, you know, like, which sounds very broad, but it's kind of the setting and everything have kind of made it this quasi recognizable sort of sense of Ireland, like where I'm from. All most of the places are kind of set on based on like places I've seen or I've been to. And then the critical side is looking at a specific figure, because my short stories would fall under the genre umbrella of weird fiction. So I'm looking at H.P. Lovecraft and I'm looking at his influence, and I'm kind of, my whole thing is about kind of like trying to break his influence, because he's now kind of a figure that's very critically, there's a lot of critical engagement with him, but it tends to kind of overlook a lot of the less savory stuff about his work. His influence is ongoing without really that kind of like sort of saying, well, why is this kind of like his, why is his definition of weird fiction the one that we're all trying to uphold whenever it's based on this and this, you know what I mean? So that's kind of what I'm looking at.
What is weird fiction? I've never heard this term.
Well, it's kind of one of those amorphous terms. So weird fiction would kind of be like, it's a sister genre to like gothic fiction and magical realism, but it sort of tends to go more for like an atmospheric sense of dread, kind of like this sort of
the woo-woo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. Yeah, so I'm kind of interested in that kind of idea of dread and kind of looking at a sort of amorphous looking future and how that relates to like the climate crisis and environmental stuff and all. So that's the creative side of things. That's what I'm interested in. But I'm also kind of interested in kind of looking at Lovecraft and being like, can we just maybe like put him away for a second?
Because like, you know, me with his Casey
definition.
Yes.
I get it. That's wonderful. It sounds like you're both working on great projects.
Have you any advice for us, Beth, having been there and done it and got the t-shirt, so to speak? How would you do it again if you had to do it differently, or would you do it differently?
Not sure I would have done it differently. I know I could have done it better. There's no doubt about that. There were some things going on that sort of had me in a hurry to do it because I needed to get back to the States for something. And so I actually did the MPhil and the PhD both within 3 years, I think, was it? And I don't think that was such a smart move. What I would have done differently was gone off books for a year, come back here, dealt with the stuff that had to be dealt with, and then gone back. I regret that. The other thing I think I would have done differently was when everybody was telling me conferences, you have to go to conferences, I would have paid more attention. But because I was, again, in this time crunch to get things done, I didn't go to quite as many as I should have. Now, part of that might be because I'm an introvert, but I think it had more to do with, I just wanted to get the project done. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so my advice in regards to those two points, those regrets, I suppose, is get out there, talk to people, network with people, and also don't rush it. Mm-hmm. It's going to get done when it gets done. You know,
brilliant advice. I really do. That makes total sense.
And I'm so glad you brought up the idea of the time part of it as well, because 3 years, I feel, isn't like, it's not really enough. I found my first year was me getting to grips with a lot of the theoretical stuff, all of the background things. And by the time I'd done that in second year, I realized my project had shifted slightly because I was more aware of the current research. I was more aware of what people had already done, and the things that I was doing was a little too close to that. It was kind of moving things around. And now my funding's due to run out in April, and I'm probably looking at taking a writing up year, which is like the extra year just to kind of get everything finished. And I think I really need it, you know, like I would love an extra year of funding, you know, but sadly.
Well, the fact of the matter is, in all likelihood, not in all likelihood, but it's quite possible that when you're done, if you do decide to pursue a teaching career, it will not be full time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe it makes the most sense, really, to devote the last year of the PhD to incorporating something else in your life that's separate from it, something maybe work that's more task specific as opposed to mm-hmm. heavy brain lifting, something that you can do to keep the lights on and the rent paid that you can leave there when you leave there. Because when you start teaching, the challenge of finding time for yourself becomes astronomical. And the weight of constantly, you know, the emails, my God, the emails, it's never ending. I have to honestly say that I guess one other regret I have is not my goal. I remember saying to one of my teachers at Trinity at the time, she's like, what are you going to do? I said, I want to spend most of my time writing and I only want to teach part time. And I remember her looking at me like, oh, you poor thing. You don't have a clue, you know, what you're in for. And I did go right into full-time teaching when I came back after I finished up and came back here. And I have to say those, I think it was 7 or 8 years, I was miserable most of the time because I had forgotten what I really wanted deep down, in part because I had said it so flippantly without thinking. And usually if I say it without thinking, it's what I really mean. It's probably true for most of us. But also because I was so freaked out by her reaction of like, you can't do that, basically, is what I saw on her face. And I look at it now, I'm teaching part-time, I'm writing, I'm doing my thing. I'm like the happiest idiot in Manhattan, you know? And so keep an eye on time and the quality of life and the lifestyle you want to live as you venture out toward the end of this project.
That's very, very useful advice.
Great advice.
You have been talking recently to me about streamlining what you do, Beth, in your professional life. And I love the idea of that. I think we all could do with a little bit of that. And maybe post-pandemic living has taught us that we need to be more aware of what we take on. So how is that sort of translating for you? Have you been able to drop off bits that you don't need in your life or pick up bits that you really want to do?
I'm a big time deleter anyway. Brian Cliff, who was my colleague on Goat Rules All, would laugh about it because he saves everything. I delete everything. So on a fairly regular basis, I'm texting him and saying, hey, do you have blah, blah, blah? It's like, of course I do. You know, why don't you have it? This streamlining that I've been doing, I think is contributing. I have weekends now, Sharon. Brilliant. I can't remember the last time.
Yeah.
On last Sunday, I got the New York Times and some bagels, I mean the print copy, and I sat on the floor and ate my bagels and did the crossword and went through the paper. And it dawned on me that I probably had not done that in 15 years.
Oh, wow. No.
It was.
Everybody should lie on the floor with a bagel and do the crossword. That absolutely. Sounds lovely.
Absolutely. But but the ways to do it, one for your teaching life, is to set up very firm parameters. And this took me, this I did a while ago. This isn't new, but it's something I've become much more diligent about, because during the year or so that we were teaching online, you know, the line, everything got blurred. There were no lines of division that were clear, which is on my syllabus. It says, and I reiterate it to students on a regular basis, I will answer emails Monday through Thursday between the hours of 9 and 5. That's it. And I also, I don't know if you use Blackboard, but I set up this button that says questions about assignments. So if they have a question about an assignment, they have to post it there. That I check regularly. Mm-hmm. It also means that they're checking it regularly. And if one kid found something on the syllabus, perhaps I was unclear, you know, about how to do something, they'll post it there. I'll answer it. Everybody else can see it. It's cut down on my emails. The last time I ran the numbers, I'm getting about a third of what the volume I used to get. And it's contributing to me having definitely a better quality of life. And then the other streamlining is just sitting down and forcing myself to think about what I need and what I want. And at the risk of sounding kind of cold, if there's nothing in it for me, I'm not doing it. You know,
I think that's so important, though.
It's essential. And that's not to say if somebody, you know, if a friend emails me or calls me up and says, hey, I've got this chapter I'm struggling with, can you take a look at it for me? I won't do it, because what I'm getting out of that is helping a friend. Do you know what I mean? But everything else, no, I just can't. And as often as I'm saying no to something that doesn't have it in it for me, I'm saying yes to things that on paper really have no professional benefit to me, but I think they're going to be fun. I'm saying yes to fun and no to not necessarily fun.
We have like episode titles for the edit, because we need yes to fun as like the episode title.
We do. Or my favorite, I have it on a t-shirt, is seek the joy.
That's perfect. I think we
need the joy to end
on that note, because we are running out of time. Beth, we could talk to you all day. We didn't even get through any of the questions that we had prepared, because we just knew that it would be very organic and natural, and you're such a joy to speak to. You've really given us a lot to think about, so thank you so much.
It was my pleasure, and I wish you both nothing but success as you start the back nine of your projects. You have to keep me up to date on things.
We will. Thank you so much, Beth.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Edit with Emma Devlin, Sharon Dempsey, and Neve McCann as part of the Seamus Heaney Center podcast. The Seamus Heaney Center podcast was created in a small back room by Stephen Sexton and Rachel Brown. It is produced and edited by Susie Bloom and features original music by Connor McCafferty. With thanks as always to our guest writers and to our students for initiating this series of pilot programs.